yesterday, a child came out to wonder. Caught a dragonfly inside a jar. Fearful when the sky was full of thunder, and tearful at the falling of a star. And the seasons, they go round and round, and the pains of ponies go up and down. We're captive on a carousel. Behind from where we came, and go round and round and round in a circle. Then the child moved 10 times round the seasons, skated over 10 clear frozen streams. Words like, when you're older, must appease him, and promises of someday make his dreams. And the seasons, they go round and round, and the painted ponies go up and down. We're captive on the carousel.
Good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great start to your day. We want to thank all our listeners that contributed to making WOWD Tacoma Park the best in DC by supporting us in our March 4th fund drive. We appreciate your generous donations very much and for supporting our station. We hope you've enjoyed Meg this morning with her eclectic music selections. She's amazing. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we are the hosts of the Art is Experience radio show.
Hi. The Art is Experience is an hour-long radio show dedicated to looking at art. We hope that Tom and I can introduce our listeners to what we've been looking at and help you when you visit the exhibit, create in your soul, in your experience, your own work of art. We have an Art is Experience page on Facebook where we put images of the things we're talking about. And it's also a place we'd love our listeners to give us ideas and feedback. So please look at it while you're listening. You can stream the program at tacomaradio.org. Also, we are putting podcasts of this show on my website, sheilablake.com, and on artasexperience.com. You can listen anytime. And the podcast can also be found on iTunes.
Well, Sheila and I really had fun doing our last show titled Art and Fear. We feel it was a very important show. Sheila brought up early in the show about play and the need to play when we're being creative and making art. Let us begin our show with Sheila's idea about child play in creativity and fear.
Well, that idea of play, you know, think of art as play or think of art as therapy. People tell me this, and I have a hard time with these concepts because I'm kind of nose to the grindstone, you know, discipline. And to me, play means to amuse oneself by engaging in imaginative pretense without seriousness or understanding. And that's the definition. Along these same lines, saying that art is therapy assumes a cathartic function that allows us to expel our inner conflicts and do better in real life. So play does, though, release us to experimentation and exploring the possibilities of materials and being open to the moment. That's very important. What's evident in the work we're going to talk about is there's both play and therapy, but with discipline and a seriousness of purpose.
Absolutely, yeah. Sheila. Yeah, those are really important that our listeners know, discipline and purpose.
Yes. So I'm big on discipline.
Big on purpose.
So I've never understood why Paul Klee is a giant. And His paintings are mostly tiny. He made puppets for his son. He never came to the U.S., even though he influenced so many artists that were giants that led the way to modern art. Those giants, Courbet, Duchamp, Malevich, Pollock, Warhol, those are the artists that opened the doors for a generation of artists to explore. But Paul Klee is behind all of it.
And that's what we're going to talk about today. You know, this childlike approach to play, as Sheila describes, is very evident in the current exhibition at the Phillips Collection, which is off of 21st Street and Massachusetts Avenue Northwest. The Phillips is one of D.C.'s great jewels and museums, and the exhibition is titled 10 Americans After Paul Klee. The exhibition is a big one, and it goes until May 6th. There is an admission fee to the museum, but the Phillips Collection is always worth the price of admission, and this show is a treat for the child and all of us. It occurs to me that it might have been fun to take your children to see the exhibition and to see what the kind of reaction you get from the work. I can hear them humming in the galleries, "Mommy, Mommy, Daddy, Daddy, I did a drawing just like that in nursery school on Friday." I can hear it now. The exhibition premise is interesting as it highlights how Paul Klee, a Swiss-born German artist who lived from 1879 to 1940, was inspirational to a host of American artists in the mid-20th century. This exhibition brings to light through 60 works from many artists how influential Paul Klee was to the American Abstract Expressionist movement and the color field painters. These 10 American artists basically took the torch from Paul Klee and reinvented art in America via adaptations from Paul Klee's ideologies, artistic development, and the interest in visual language that embraces music, numbers, color theory, and symbols. As the title of our program indicates, The Art of a Child, Paul Klee and His Legacy, Sheila and I are going to explore the childlike nature of his work and how his intuitive mark making opened up so many avenues of explorations to Americans delving into abstraction with childlike qualities.
Okay, Tom. So I know we're going to talk about Paul Klee's legacy, which is opening the doors to artists and trying to manifest in the conscious world the forces which have been otherwise inaccessible to them. That is very important. But at first, I'd like to tell a story that introduces this idea. It's about my oldest friend, Gloria. Okay, so Gloria and I grew up in a neighborhood right off Grand Central Parkway in Queens. And when I was a little kid, I would walk over to Gloria's house. We spent a lot of time either digging in the sand pile across the street or coloring on Gloria's screen porch. We had names for our crayons, spinach green, flesh orange, and that was way before the Crayola Company got smart and named their 64 colors. So Gloria grew up to be a professor of comparative literature and women's studies at University of Southern California, and I grew up to be an artist. But before that, while Gloria was living in New York, she was taking care of her two little girls and writing her PhD thesis on an unknown surrealist painter living in New Mexico named Leonora Carrington. There was nothing written about her, and Gloria was trying to interpret Leonora's art, which fascinated her. But not knowing if she was even on the right track, she sent Leonora a copy of what she'd written so far. And then she got a reply and said, "No, no, no, it's all wrong. You don't understand anything."
That's the way, Leonora. You tell her.
So Gloria bought a Mexican dress in the village, and she stood in front of the mirror, and she raised her arms, and she said, "If I can't go to Mexico, let Mexico come to me." And the phone rang, and it was Leonora Carrington, and she'd come to New York. And that began their lifelong friendship and Gloria's acquaintance with shamans, vision quests, and spirit guides. Luckily, Gloria's kids were in summer camp, so she went with Leonora to Paris and Mexico, and she learned a central core theme of Leonora Carrington's artistic vision, which is the vanishing of ancient worlds possessing esoteric knowledge and their disappearance into the unconscious. Repeat. Okay. It is the vanishing of ancient worlds possessing advanced esoteric knowledge and their disappearance into the conscious. Think about Kara Walker and what she's doing.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Back into the consciousness. Bringing the unconscious back
right? into the world.
Yeah,
so these ancient worlds have been conquered. They've been excised and they've been banished from our current system of knowledge. Their female deities and their sacred symbol system was replaced by a sacred system, symbol system that was presided over by male deities. These ideas are central to Leonora Carrington's art and to Gloria's writings on ecofeminism and the reflowering of the goddess. And yesterday, after 50 years, Gloria was the keynote speaker at the opening of the Leonora Carrington Museum in San Luis Potosi, Mexico. Last year, the New Yorker did a wonderful article about Leonora, and she's finally getting recognition. But who is she? She grew up in England and studied art in London. When she was 19, she was really drawn to the surrealist, mysterious artistic codes. So like many of the surrealists, Carrington came from a privileged background that felt like an impediment to her creativity. She felt suffocated by the rigidity and the class prejudices. She was presented at Buckingham Palace, and she was attracted to the transformative potency of the surrealist aesthetics, and she was completely powerfully drawn to Max Ernst's work. So later she managed to meet him at a party where Max Ernst was visiting from Paris, and the two artists powerfully connected and they dropped everything. He dropped his wife, she dropped her life, and they went to live in Paris.
Uh-oh.
And Ernst was 25 years older than Carrington. And he was also an established member of the Surrealist Inner Circle. And this was sort of her entree into the boys' club of Surrealism. Picasso, de Chirico, Dali, Miró, and Klee. And she immersed herself in Surrealist practices in her painting and her writing. And while her Surrealist male friends obsessed over Freudian and Jungian psychology, she delved into mythology, animism, and female sexuality. So with the onslaught of the Nazis, Max Ernst was forced, along with many other artists, we talk about that a lot, to flee from Paris, and he went to New York. And Leonora went to Spain. She had a psychotic breakdown. She was hospitalized, treated with shock therapy, and eventually she went to live in Mexico. And she lived in Mexico and New York for the rest of her life. The tendency of women artists to be overshadowed by their male partners is sadly a recurring one. And for women involved in the Surrealist circle, the situation was even more fraught because the Surrealists were fascinated by women, beautiful women, mad women, young women, or preferably all three conjoined into an ideal figure of the child woman whose untamed nature might be the conduit to a realm of fantasy and indulgence. Maybe this is why Carrington identified so closely with horses, because she could imagine herself like them being used as a vehicle. So I'm going to tell you what I've come to understand about this exhibition. It begins with Paul Klee. When Klee was 20, Sigmund Freud published his Interpretation of Dreams. Freud and his new theories about the unconscious mind, the underpinnings of human sexuality as the basis for our feelings and reactions, had a profound impact on culture, and it had an impact that remains today. Artists and writers were liberated from the constraints of conventional society, and they followed the teachings of Freud and Carl Jung. Surrealism was the 20th century avant-garde movement in art and literature, which sought to release the creative potential of the unconscious mind. They wanted to get beyond the surface appearance of the world, a technique that they used to implement an irrational juxtaposition of images and automatic writing and symbols of religion and mythology. They used every technique they could, and this was true in music also. Art was an opportunity to get to their authentic selves. It was the impulse of going to a childlike innocence, to react as a child, to unveil the symbols that are signals from our unconscious. What we see and experience as playfulness has its roots in this search. At the same time Freud published his Interpretations of Dreams, Paul Klee was investigating childhood sexuality as a crucial force in his art. I really have to say that in the exhibition, the wall text misses the whole point of what Clay and his friends Kandinsky, Ernst, etc. were delving into. They were searching for ways to connect with their unconscious, and the language of automatic writing, symbols, myths was a way into that. It was completely influenced by Freud and Jung. It's not play or style or experimentation for its own sake. Rothko and Pollock, along with the writers of the time through psychoanalysis, saw art as a way to delve into the unconscious mind and make it visible. The fact that it was considered a breach of privacy, maybe, to investigate this is perhaps relevant to why it's not being said. So do you need to think about Jung and Freud to appreciate the art in this exhibition? No, I don't think so at all. I think these artists, along with the poets and novelists of the early mid-century, were trying to shed the old approaches of making art in order to find a more fundamental reality. They didn't know what this reality was, but they were interested and hopeful that the new psychological and philosophical discoveries would help in their explorations. They talked about it, wrote letters about it, and they went into analysis. But over and above all, they were artists, and they knew it was their responsibility to show their discoveries so people would respond aesthetically. They weren't philosophers. They weren't analyzing concepts. They were looking for subjects to paint and for paintings that would, as we now say, blow our minds. Now they've turned over to us to encounter and respond to. Later in the show, we'll look at a little more closely at these paintings.
Well, one of the things that you bring up, Sheila, I think is really important is sometimes we can overanalyze art in a cerebral way that actually kind of kills the visual. Mm-hmm. And I think to kind of maintain the childlike quality of Paul Klee, we have to really kind of just surrender to the visual and not, you know, get too tied up and tangled in the web of Jung and Freud, which were very important, obviously. Mm-hmm. But we have to just kind of see the artwork as it is in front of our eyes. But there are two things that stand out to me about Paul Klee's legacy and his bio, and that's his connection to the Bauhaus, or the design period called the building house, from the German word Bauhaus, which was an art and design movement from Germany from 1919 to 1969. The Bauhaus was founded by architect Walter Gropius as a radical concept coming out of the annihilation of European culture after World War I. Its objective was to reimagine the material world to reflect a unity in all the arts, and the key is all the arts, a unification of art and design as a single form of creative expression that encompassed architecture, graphic design, crafts like textiles and woodworking and ceramics, metalwork, sculpture, painting, the decorative arts, theater, poetry, and music, all the arts working as one. This immersion in a school provided the need and desire to create useful, functional, and beautiful objects for a new system of living after the tragedies of World War I. Well, Paul Klee was part of an artistic dream team of an exceptional creators, educators, philosophers, and thinkers. We had Paul Gropius, Wassily Kandinsky, Johann Eiten, Joseph and Annie Albers, Mariana Brandt, Moholy Nagy, and Mies de Rondero, and Marcel Breuer. These are outstanding designers and artists working together at the school. These artists were brilliant, progressive, practical, and they were percolating generations of talent in all the arts. And I think that's one of the things that Paul Klee is really kind of known for. He was also an educator. And Paul Klee came from a family of musicians, and Klee was an excellent violinist as a child. He won accolades for his playing in a prodigy class of musicians, which he later gave up in his late teens. The music must have always been ringing in his head. With music comes numbers and math. With math comes geometry, algebra, calculus, and trigonometry. And then with math comes abstractions, symbols, pictograms, and glyphs, and visual language. Well, the visual language comes from the basic elements of art and design, like line, shape, form, and color. Color not being too basic, really, but we see a lot of color in this exhibition. So Here's where we start and end with Paul Klee. He gives us a new way of communicating simple visual language with sophistication and whimsy. Play is what Sheila called it. But is that not what children like to do is play, right? They just want to play.
Yeah, well, Gloria and I loved coloring books. But believe me, we didn't do anything that looked like Paul Klee.
Oh, wait a minute. Look back a little and remember.
Yeah. And if you give a kid a couple of blobs of finger paints, they'll have a wonderful time. But it's not going to look like a Kandinsky. Of course, there is the beautiful color harmonies that Klee found in his exploration of color theory and design. It's more that he put himself in a place of innocent reaction, but with a sophisticated eye, and it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and absolutely. And the exhibition juxtaposes Klee and 10 American artists that were instrumental in the abstract art of the 1940s through the 1980s. The abstract expressionist movement centered mainly in New York City, which were represented by William Basiotis, Adolf Gottlieb, Theodore Stamos, and Bradley Walker Tomlin. Jackson Pollock comes from California and lands in New York City, and Mark Toby, who comes from California, goes to New York City and then goes back out west. These younger artists like Robert Motherwell and Norman Lewis are represented in both the abstract expressionist movements and the color field painters, which were centered in D.C., Washington, right here, and New York City. D.C.-based Gene Davis and Kenneth Nolan are mainly color field painters, which have also roots in abstract expressionism. But who cares about the movements? Let's get to the childlike sophistication of Paul Klee and the intuitive nature of the marks like a child. Sheila, this childlike mark-making that we see in the exhibit, why are we calling it childlike? It's easy to view, but it's a little more than just child's play, isn't it?
Well, you know, until now, I haven't understood Paul Klee. I really haven't. And that's gotten in my way of loving his paintings, and I knew that. And I kept trying to find sort of what's underneath that. And to doing this show and doing the research for the show, I felt like my heart is open to him. My eyes are open to him. But until now, I never understood why he's a giant, even after his paintings are mostly tiny. He made puppets for his son. He never came to the U.S., even though he influenced so many artists. So yes, I could see he was experimental with colors and materials and almost childlike in his images, inventive. But I have never really understood what his symbols for. He made 10,000 pictures in his 60 years.
That's amazing.
It is. I just didn't understand what was underneath it and what was his profound influence on these very American abstract painters. I have a book. It's a teaching sketchbook or lecture notes by Klee. And I could hardly keep awake trying to read it. I thought, I'll get to the bottom of this. His theories on proportionate line and structure, dimension and balance, gravitational curve, kinetic and chromatic energy. Are you asleep yet?
No, I'm not asleep, okay. Sheila. I'm wide awake in this show and with the mic in front of me. But you know, I think it's important that Klee was an educator, an intellectual making mm-hmm. art. I mean, he taught at the Bauhaus, as I said, and he taught with these other, you know, dream team artists. So there's a lot of theoretical stuff, and that's brain work. But the optical stuff, the painting and the drawing and all that, putting it down on paper in design, painting, and drawing and architecture, that's something else. These artists were writing important treatises about color theory, space and balance, and the spiritual nature of color, line, and shape and form. So they were kind of out there, and they were very cerebral. But here's where Klee spreads a wide net out to maximize his influence as an educator. He was inspirational as a teacher and an artist. The exhibition groups certain artists with certain works by Klee. They put them together in the exhibition space, and it's really very evident how he inspired these 10 artists. And all of them have had a secure place in the explosion of abstraction after World War II in America, and again, like I said, primarily in New York City and D.C. This exhibition represents all these artists very well, and we're going to talk about it. And it's a huge array of paintings, but it's not just painting, and I think that's really important. There's a lot of hosts of media and experimental work in that show.
There is. The clays are mostly small, and they're sometimes tiny, and they're done on cardboard with colored paste. What is that? Oil on burlap, which gives this kind of subdued, infused light. Newspaper. Clay's method of working on unprimed canvas set the stage for a generation of color field painters. He uses tools to scratch into the surface. There's a consciousness of delicacy and texture and depth, and sometimes like an excavation of the surface. And one of my favorite paintings at the Phillips is Excavation by de Kooning. And they have a lot to say to each other.
Mm. Yeah.
And Helen Frankenthaler, she made a breakthrough in technique. She diluted oil painting, staining the canvas in this free and lyrical, almost calligraphic feeling. And Morris Lewis used another way of staining on prime canvas. Norman Lewis used sand. I love these watercolors of William Basiotis of the underwater world. It's an exposure of the mysteries of layers beneath the surface. Another pertinent observation, that there is a discovery among abstract artists, and like Gene Davis, Frank Stella, Kenneth Nolan, that if you follow a pattern or a logical idea for a work, like a grid or stripes, just in painting of that idea, carrying it through to the end, something will happen. Look at Frank Stella's stripes or Gene Davis's stripes of Kenneth Nolan's chevrons. The careful, task-like quality of painting will produce something made and very human.
And yeah, we're going to talk about that in a minute, but it's time to take a break now. And we're going to listen to music that has been inspired by Paul Klee's works. And there's a lot of work out there in the way of music that composers kind of heeded to Paul Klee's inspiration as well. And remembering the big bands, jazz, and all kinds of music were percolating at the time of Paul Klee. And while you're listening, take a moment to go online and press the donate button at TacomaRadio.org. Your generous donations are tax deductible. Let's listen up to Inspirations by Paul Klee. Bye.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWD Tacoma Park 94.3 FM.
Well, so how are we going to begin? You know, we Sheila and I walk into the Phillips lower lobby, and there's a little exhibition before you get to the main exhibition, and we're greeted by this fantastic group of small works by Paul Klee. It's like the antipasto before the big meal in the exhibition. And these are Klee's works that Duncan Phillips, the collector that, you know, opened the Phillips Collection Museum, he gobbled them up like right out of the, you know, studios, it seems, of Paul Klee, right off the easel. Were not these fabulous, Sheila? Yeah. I mean, it was like a playroom.
They are beautiful. They are jewels. So a lot of the value of art is derived from the mysterious ways it affects, informs, and influences us. In a sense, it allows us to create ourselves in conversation with the work of art. There's often a feeling both in the artist and in the viewer that the artist not so much creates but reveals a reality. Part of the aesthetic experience has to do with a feeling of revelation of some half-perceived, apprehended truth which is discovered and not invented. So the first painting is called The Arrival of Jugglers, and it looks like an excavation of a small ship with a plank leading to the performers. The color is delicate. It's pinks, greens, pale. Looks like something unearthed from an ancient time. Another painting, The Way to the Citadel, is a maze of faceted colored planes that construct and deconstruct a beautiful, translucent, and prismatic environment with only arrows leading the way to the heights and off the canvas. And efflorescence, which means to blossom, is a gorgeous small piece of art. These works, they're all part of the Phillips Collection, are the innocent treasures. Enjoy them at this exhibition.
Well, it goes back to this childlike quality, and it kind of reminded me of like sitting on my butt as a young child on Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, and playing with shells, moving them around in the sand. I would draw on the wet sand with the edge of a shell and watch the water wash them away like a natural etch-a-sketch. It was magical and mysterious all the time. You know, like sitting in the middle of a garden and playing with the flowers and the bugs buzzing around and playing pick-up sticks with real twigs and sticks from fallen trees, or practicing numbers with your friends in different languages, like from 1 to 10, saying them in English, French, German, or Greek. I mean, it was so much fun. And these works have that like the kind of childlike visual language. These works in the lower lobby brought me to the sensibilities of innocence and fun. I mean, yet somehow sophisticated. They're really amazing. Duncan Phillips was quite brave to bring them to America, as Paul's Klee's kind of work was not what was in at the time. I mean, and Phillips called Klee a dreamer, a poet, and a brooding rebel. Some of us were probably, you know, thinking about the same thing, and that's what our parents thought of us when we were children. So it's just perfect.
It is perfect. So the room with the history, they do have one room where the walls are covered with text and yes, photographs. And at least for me, because I love to know who fits in where, I have to know where these artists are coming from, who they were communicating with. And I didn't see anything on the walls about the influence of psychoanalysis on the artists. And as I said before, maybe it was considered an invasion of privacy or gossip, but it really is essential. But remember when we did a show a long time ago called What If You Don't Get It?
That was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. But getting it is partly knowing where and when and who these artists were hanging out with. So I've always been puzzled by the early paintings of Jackson Pollock and Mark Rothko before they developed into their mature style. But I think psychoanalysis is key, and they both were in Jungian analysis because they were trying to stop drinking.
Yeah, no, I think this room is important. It's kind of cumbersome, but the history charts and what was going on is really important in the kind of the dynamism and flux of the time between Europe and America. And there was a lot going on between the world wars. And I think also it kind of addresses how the artists were moving from one continent to the other. And then there were the critics, important gallery owners like Peggy Guggenheim, and there was patrons of the art. So it was, I think it was an important room. Lots of osmosis going on here in the art scene. So I think the room was good. It's a big exhibition, but I would take a few minutes to read that, some of that stuff. But let's get into the meat of the exhibition here. And Kenneth Nolan, because he was a D.C.-based artist.
He was. And he actually came from being influenced by clay, but he became a color field painter, and he practiced what we call hard edge abstraction. And Nolan was interested in removing all texture, gesture, emotional content from his paintings. He even executed some works on shape canvases that were filled by their compositions from edge to edge, so it left no marginal space for suggestions of depth or background. And in these shaped works, the viewer no longer looks into the picture. Instead, the work of art coexists in the viewer's space as a complete object. So what's left? No space, no imagery. The targets and chevrons aren't targets and chevrons. They're just a way to put paint next to other paint. And no gesture, no emotional content. What's left is some really pretty color.
Actually, Nolan uses color in a really nice way, his red and greens together. Untitled from 1952 is a powerful labyrinth and graphic, which is really a small painting but very powerful. The red lines have a kind of jazzy textural fashion with your eyes moving around at the canvas. Sometimes it's like a pinball running around the canvas in a pinball machine. And color, it certainly is.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, and Adolf Gottlieb, he was a New Yorker, and he found his inspiration in the work of the expatriate European surrealists who'd fled to New York to escape the Nazis. And Freudian psychoanalytic theory was a crucial component of the surrealist sensibility, and it also enjoyed a huge following among New York intellectuals. And my father, too, was in analysis. It shows you how pervasive it was. For Gottlieb, an additional appeal was that Freudian theory was saturated with allusions to classical mythology, the most famous instance of course being Freud's theory of the Oedipus complex. Rothko and Gottlieb were developing a close friendship, and their work for a brief time was indistinguishable from each other. So they each had to stake out their own territory. I have a friend who has a print. It's large. And she said, "Who do you think did this?" And I said, "Gottlieb." "It's completely Gottlieb." And she said, "No, it's not. It's Rothko." So they really were right there together. And so what developed in Gottlieb art was the pictograph, which divided the canvas surface into irregular grids that contained a variety of signs, shapes, and symbols purporting to harbor allusions to classical mythology. The first of these was called, what else? Eyes of Oedipus. Mainly of eyes and noses. And within a year or two, Gottlieb developed the pictograph into brilliant compositions of mask-like images and dazzling color that together recall us to the primitive rites and practices of the ancient world.
You know, many of us probably, you know, look at the Rothko paintings of his mature period, but his early periods are right out of mythology.
Yeah, they are.
And it's interesting. Yes. Yeah, it's quite a distinction there. Mm-hmm. Well, I volunteered to talk about Gene Davis on the show, and I've always had a lot of trouble looking at Gene Davis's painting. But to see that in the music, the context of music and clay, it helped me kind of understand Gene Davis a bit more. His early paintings and drawings, they showed the influence of clay, and also Arshile Gorky, who is another a wonderful artist that we've actually talked about in another show. This same preference for spontaneity characterized the selections of the paintings in his large, large stripe paintings that he has. But, you know, they're not based really on theorems or formulas. And Davis often compared himself to a jazz musician playing by ear, describing his approach as playing by eye, which I think is a really nice thing to say. Mm-hmm. And since Clay was a violinist and his paintings often thought of musical compositions, I see the relationship now. So I really learned a lot in the show, much like you learned about Clay, Sheeler. And Davis worked both large and small on his works. And, you know, I'm so glad I kind of got a chance to study Gene Davis in the exhibition. He has this wonderful piece called In the Garden, which was these black grass-like vertical marks with these orange seeds that seem to fly off them. It's very playful and simply beautiful. There's a lot of rhythm in his work, and of course, rhythm is about music. So why don't we talk a little about Motherwell here, because he's one of my favorites.
Sure. Robert Motherwell was one of the American artists whose work had been influenced by the surrealist ideas of automatism, which is a process of making art through subconscious free association, along with Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, Willem Baziotis, and Hans Hofmann Motherwell. Motherwell was the youngest of this group of abstract painters, and he sought to create imagery that communicated the emotional truths of an authentic self, and it reflected a collective human consciousness. I thought the Motherwell works in this show were great. He's so good at the juxtaposition of simple shapes for the most emotional impact. It's so good. I almost distrust him.
Oh, you said that for so many years, and I'm just such a big fan. Such
a big fan of
Robert. You're getting on the trust wagon here.
I am.
Well, there's a rawness and crudeness to the shapes that I find a lot of power in Motherwell's work. And he uses these neutral tones, which appeal to me. His figure in black, which is Girl with Stripes in the exhibition, evokes a primitive raw quality that you might see in Central African cloth dyeing or mask making. And then there's the concept of a woman, which is an interesting piece that actually reminds me of his colleague, Willem de Kooning, as well. It's frenetic, and it's somewhat neurotic, but it's raw, and I really like it like that. The next artist in the show, which has another raw quality in his work, is the artist Theodore Stamos. But his work is like a of children inspired by nature, and I think a lot of our listeners could relate to that as children, how we're inspired by nature. And Clay was a proponent of this, very much about nature in his works. And, you know, these fantastic works are definitely inspired by Clay. Theodore Stamos was an artist I had a keen eye for, even as a student. His works venture into the world that mixes nature, the natural and the mythic. I mean, he was a Greek-American who loved the sea and his mystery of the sea, the underworld, the gods of the sea, the gods of the winds. And his work addresses the cosmos and the infinite. And that's something the ancient Greeks really were inspired by. His work, though, has a sense of turbulence and mystery. His abstract nature in the physical, amorphous, and malleable things are about the earthly and the universal and the voluminous and the crude. A friend of mine, John Zimbalist, knew him, and they used to hang out together in the summers, and he was a rough and tumble guy. He was kind of gruff. He was outspoken, and I know that he had a huge ego. His work speaks to that. He became very infamous at the end of his career when he got involved with this estate fiasco with his friend and the executor of his estate and the galleries that represented Mark Rothko. And that's another story, but his career took a nosedive after that tragedy. But he talks about alphabets and pictograms and glyphs. The word glyph, I have to kind of say it, the word hieroglyph comes from that, and it means to sculpt. And that's the abstractions of basic ancient language that the Egyptians were fond of, and other Assyrians were fond of that too. So he kind of gives us a visual language with his marks on the canvas in a sculptural way. His work stands out of the exhibition in color and lack of visual delicacy, which the others in the exhibition were much more delicate than he was.
Mm-hmm. So I always seem to be thinking about Jackson Pollock. I mean, much more because he keeps coming up as the most influential artist ever. So Pollock listened to jazz in his studio, not just for days, day and night, 3 days running. And he listened to the musical greats like Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and Louis Armstrong. And he told his wife, Lee Krasner, that jazz was the only other creative thing happening in the country. Pollock loved the freedom, tempo, and energy of freeform jazz and bebop. He immersed himself in both the act of painting and the hot, spontaneous, swinging pace of the music. Pollock's abstract works achieve a visual symphony out of improvised paint dripping, a harmonic structure from accident and chance. But this use of spontaneous improvisation is essentially parallel to the jazz aesthetic, in which the performer has the freedom to improvise solos and interpret the lines of music without losing the overall structure. Pollock shared many of the principles of jazz. His work expresses an intense energy, and he uses colors, splatters, and lines of the paint, much like the melodies, rhythms, and structures of the music. Behind the energy and the drips, there is a deep structure. The structure appears as space in the same way as the air in music. He was a great artist who couldn't stop drinking. In 1937, he began receiving psychiatric treatment for alcoholism from a Jungian analyst who fueled his interest in symbolism and Native American art. In 1939, Pollock discovered Pablo Picasso's show at the Museum of Modern Art, and Picasso's artistic experimentation encouraged Pollock to push the boundaries of his own work. He found a means to perfectly express the unseen spirit of the unconscious, to be both the dancer and the dance, the painter and the painting. When he was 44 years old, he was killed when he was drunk and drove his car into a tree.
Well, that's one of the great tragedies of the 20th mm-hmm. century American art, for sure. I'd like to talk about Norman Lewis, because he's a standout in the exhibition as the only African-American artist recognized in this group. And he clearly suffered from the dominance of the white race in the art world. He sold very little in his lifetime compared to the white-dominated artists of the New York Abstract Expressionist movement, where the critics were white and so were the gallery owners. He was a very brave guy. He was certainly very brilliant. He was a native of Harlem, and he was very gifted and well-trained as part of this group of African-Americans in Harlem at the time, which was really percolating in the arts. We had Romare Bearden and Hal Woodruff, and there's a whole list of others. His venture into abstract expression was risky and really gutsy. At the time, African-American artists were concentrating more on social realist issues, but he took the work into abstraction, which was not the norm. Lewis's work, like Pollock's, was inspired by music and certainly jazz. These works are very musical and dreamlike, kind of smoky and dark. Like jazz, there were several things going on his canvases and papers at the same time, kind of visually syncopated. That's how I see his work, with multicolored environments and ink-like linear forms in the same space, things kind of floating and moving around. He was very experimental in his works. I have to say, I find his work very frenetic and somewhat neurotic, and I have to say, you see the relationship to clay. A couple of the works deal with carnivale, which is kind of music and kind of frenetic kind of thing, before Lent starts. And in 1958, he was really showing a very wonderful and playful and rhythmic side. I have to say that. I think his work was really different in the show, and he really kind of has an interesting way of seeing space. Another artist in the show that Sheila has already mentioned was the William Basiotis, who was the pride of joy of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, much like Andy Warhol was. Anyway, his work has a more whimsical and kind of interest in automatism, which is kind of automatic writing. And it's also called psychography, which is writing automatically without your brain even knowing it. And his very work is also related to Robert Motherwell's. The Falcon and Pierrot are two important paintings in the exhibition that are both intuitive, natural, and automatic. These are really beautiful works and a very strong part of his work. But sadly, he died very young at the age of 50, and his legacy was cut short in the first generation of abstract expressionism.
And Bradley Walker Tomlin, who was born in 1899 and died in 1953, belonged to the generation of New York's dual school abstract expressionists. Taubman's life and his work were marked by a persistent, restless striving toward perfection in a truly classical sense of the word, towards that inner logic of form that would produce a total harmony, an unalterable rightness, a sense of miraculous completion. I have that in my own work really expresses something I strive for. It was only during the last 5 years of his life that goal was fully reached and his art flowered with a sure strength and authority. Taubman turned away from cubism to adopt a more spontaneous and abstract style, and he began experimenting with automatic writing and Japanese calligraphy. Taubman's work also approaches mystical rhythmic textures. They are very improvisational and orchestral.
Well, the thing about Walker Taubman in the show is his paintings are the largest, and they're really, the scale really impresses me. There's not a lot of color in the work, but the scale and the size in which he worked was really different, and I'm glad he was included. Again, he died very young too, and he never really evolved his musical journey. Well, I could talk all day about Mark Tobey, but we're really running out of time today. Mark Tobey is included in the show, and he's really one of my favorite abstract expressionists. And very interesting. He was grew up a Christian, but he converted to the Baha'i faith, and he traveled the Middle East, Turkey, Greece, Japan. He was totally enthralled by ancient calligraphy, and he really gave us some powerful works in the show. And I have to say, I feel really badly about it. But we're going to end the show with Stephen Winwood's famous Bring Me to Higher Love. And I think that's what his work is about. Mark Tobey is really a genius, and he gives us this innocent, untainted quality of a child. But yet you know that his work is deadly serious in the process. His white writing paintings, such as Night Flight and the extensions from Baghdad, need a lot of patience to approach and enjoy. I think his works take Paul Klee's inspiration to the holy child realm that embrace many religions in the world, and he really has a definite spiritual direction. Well, The Ten Americans After Paul Klee is an adventure into the world of simple visual language that is thoughtful, sophisticated, and beautiful. The Phillips Collection exhibition is really a show that takes time, so you need to be patient, and we've said that many times on our show. We invite you to think about the development of your own language skills, whether it's visual or verbal. Do you remember how fabulous it was to communicate something honestly, simply, and clearly? The communication of children is pure, innocent, intuitive, inventive, and always experimental. The word wonder and play comes through here. We invite you to experience the visual in this wonderful exhibition, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. Sheila, tell our listeners about some upcoming programming.
Sure. I do want to add something here, that this show is called 10 Americans After Paul Klee. It might as well have been 10 American Men After Paul Klee. Just want to.
I knew you had to
there.
Get that in, Sheila.
I had
Sheila.
To put it in.
Oh, okay. Go for it.
Okay. So maybe they'll hear me at the Phillips. Anyway, Tom and I are constantly coming up with new ideas for new shows, and sometimes we do them now, sometimes we skip a time. We're being distracted all the time by so much that's going on here. And we're going to do a show on the maladies of artists, and this will be a program about artists' lives making art in war, in disease, and health crisis. Many of the artists lived and died with disease that ended their creative journeys and cut their lives short, and in some cases very short, some of the artists that we've just spoken about.
For sure, right.
Yeah.
And the next trip, we're going to take our listeners to the Textile Museum, which is part of George Washington University. I'm a big fan of the Textile Museum, and there's a blockbuster exhibition on Central Asian ikats. In other words, the tie dyeing from Central Asia. And the exhibition is called Buying in the Clouds, and there's going to be a lot of color in there. Well, stay tuned to our next exciting programming here at WOWD Tacoma Park. We have Bobby Hill. Bobby's just, he's on top of his game every time, and he's going to share his incredible knowledge and musical depth with his musical program today, right after us from 10 to 1, Avant-Garde Jazz, right here. So keep that dial fixed with Bobby. Bobby also is going to give us his expertise on Wednesday with Borderlines. Wednesday mornings from 10 a.m. to noon, no borders, no lines, with great music variety. Listen to our friend Gail Behrens from 8 to 10 and the Night Ride Home. Well, we thank you for listening. We're going to close our show with a classic by Stephen Woodward. Have a great day, everyone.
And you're tuned to WOWDLP, Tacoma Park.